At the end of the Thursday night sitting we have here every week, which is 2 hours of sitting, we usually recite a sutra, and it's often the Heart Sutra. And I understand it's the most loved and chanted sutra in the Buddhist world, worldwide. And I like it because even though it's a Mahayana text, which means it's not quite in our tradition, but it's sort of a first cousin, you know, it's so easy for this practice to seem complicated and like there's all these parts and all these lists, and we're focusing on our breath and we're doing mindfulness practice and we're following the precepts, and it feels like sometimes it's a lot. It can get complicated. We can get lost in the trees. And sometimes it's good to come back to the forest, the sort of very fundamental concepts or the fundamental truths of this path that everything else springs from, which is why I love the Heart Sutta, because it's kind of the cliff notes. In one page, it sort of spells everything out. And it starts by saying the Bodhisattva of great compassion, while practicing deeply with Prajnaparamita, which means just the highest wisdom, suddenly realized that everything she thought was an individual separate being was empty. There was no separation. And in that realization, her suffering and the suffering of all beings ended. Now, if that doesn't get your heart racing, I don't know what does. And the words of the Paramita, of the Prajnaparamita, are gate, gate, which means go beyond, go beyond. And then paragate, which means go way beyond what you thought was beyond. In other words, beyond even your concept of what's beyond. And then parasamgate, go beyond to the furthest shore, beyond the separate sense of self, bodhisvaha, which is at that place. Your full truth, your enlightenment is waiting for you. So that's the Prajnaparamita, the greatest mantra. So that points to a fundamental teaching of this path, which is that the ego, that part that thinks we are, is a fiction created in the mind by self-referencing and self-repetitive patterns of thinking. And that ego, what I mean, is our sense of self, when I think of Susan or Martha or Joe. And you know, it's all the thoughts that circle around that sense of self and individuality. And you know, that bring out about this bigger conceptualized version of who we think we are and who we imagine ourselves to be. And you know, for most of us, you hear about there's this kind of a trance of the thinking mind and this sense of self that's based on separation, that it really feels hard. It feels like there's all that is. Of course, there's me over here and there's you over there, and I might not even like you or agree with you, so of course it's different. That's so, so deep. And most of us are completely identified with this image of ourselves out in the world of others. I mean, we are, right? So the point is that everything you imagine yourself to be, think of all the concepts and the assumptions about yourself you make, your opinions, your lifestyle, your experience, your talents and abilities, they have one thing in common. They're all based on thoughts and thinking. And it self-references other thoughts and thinking. And I know you have to live with that a while for that to kind of hit you on a gut level, because that sounds like an idea. So they all have in common, they're all thoughts, and here's why this is important. All of your suffering is caused by your identification with those egoic circular patterns of thinking and imagining. All of it, not just some of it. And, you know, again, that's an idea. This practice is about closely examining that, truth. Now, notice that the teaching isn't that the fact that the mind thinks and imagines, that's not the problem. That's just what the mind does. It's our identification with it that is the suffering. Those are two different things. So, it's the identification thinking that it's true and thinking it's who you are. That's why there's no need to control the mind. It doesn't matter if the mind's quiet or whether it's thinking a million miles an hour or whether it's feeling and having emotions going through it or it's not, because it's not the fact that it's doing what it does, it's whether you believe in it, with this identification of yourself with it. So there's no need to control it. We just sort of create some space, gate, we go beyond that as our identification. And so here's something I wrote, that so when you look at the ego and how it's created and perpetuated, it's really important to do in our practice. In fact, that is my whole practice. The last 45 minutes, I sat here and watched the ego in motion. Don't need to create it, don't need to stop it, but just when you watch it, there's a little distance. The awareness that's watching it is a little bit different than all those patterns that are coming up. And just understand, the mind is thinking a separate self into existence. It's imagining it into existence. Which means that who and what you really are will never be found in your mind. Who you are will never be found in your mind. So, the first thing that we usually notice in practice is that we have all these thoughts, opinions, memories, plans, emotions. You notice how many of them are coming up, kind of, you know, they're sort of rolling out. It's like a TV station. Even at 2 a.m., there's stuff on the channel. You know, it's just kind of rolling along. And all these things are contained in the mind. In fact, if you look at that, you realize all of that stuff, everything about how you plan or think or remember things or plan in the future, it's all mental. But seeing this, spending our practice looking at these processes, means that you start to see this all as is in front of you. And if you can see it, by definition, it is not you. So the part of you that can see all these egoic patterns, these circular patterns of thinking that build on each other, the part of you that can see it is not identified with it, which is why this practice is so vital. It just allows a little bit of space. When you have a reactive pattern come up in your mind, you're feeling anxiety or angry, the part of you that sees it in meditation is not actually angry. You notice that? And so that's why in our practice, this little bit of space, this sliver of light that opens up between all these egoic circular processes and the awareness is the beginning of that gate process. That's the gold. You know, and I notice in myself after 25 years of practice that when I miss it, for whatever reason, that sliver begins to close. And 99% of the day, I'm lost in the trance of those circular processes. I'm just lost in them. But the practice keeps the door ajar. It really does. So what happens is this identification that is all of our suffering starts to break open, which we're all experiencing. I think all of you, a lot of us, there's many ways people describe this touching of the separation, of this breaking of identification. For me, I experience this as an inner sense of spaciousness. You realize all the noise of the mind is happening in a container that's silent and immovable. And so I experience as this silence, this container of silence that's underneath, immovable and out of time. Other people talk about they feel a little more spaciousness, like, yeah, that pattern came up, but I found I was able to just sit with it. That kind of spaciousness, that is that door opening. That is the gold. So, you know, and the other thing that that door opening opens for us is we usually attribute the problems and the difficulties and the stress of our life to external circumstances. I mean, that is so easy, right? To things that are happening at work, things that are flowing in your life in relationships, in family, in politics, in your health, and just something that's out there. You know, this thing that's going on with your neighbor or reading whatever it is in the paper or just the argument you're having with your child. But it's actually caused by our identification with all the patterns of thoughts that arise around these things. That's actually where the suffering is. So what's interesting is that separated sense, the ego-identified mind, is always looking for happiness and ease, but it's always looking for it in external circumstances, which can't ever be satisfying because they're impermanent. I mean, happiness can't be grabbed onto. You can have a moment, but then it's gone. So the ego's always looking to outside circumstances where it imagines all the problem is. You know, if it weren't for my husband, my marriage would be excellent. You know, if it weren't for my work, my job would be great. If it weren't for my mind, my meditation would be incredible. You know, I mean, that's how the ego looks at things. Happiness is pleasant and pleasurable experience, but you can't grab any of that. Because one moment my husband is wonderful and brings me chocolate, and the next minute he doesn't take out the trash. I mean, that's just life, right? So, you know, the fact is we can't find happiness outside of ourselves because anything outside of ourselves can be taken away and will be taken away. At the end, you know, when you look at the immeasurable vows of the bodhisattvas, in the end we lose everything. You know, our whole world. Well, and we're impermanent. You know, our lives are going to end. So, anyways, the point is that we suffer because we're identified with our egoic processes that are built and based on separation, that are looking for something in a place that can never be found, and because we don't go beyond it to the center of our awareness. So this is the gate, go inwardly, keep going, go beyond that, go way beyond that. Your truth is waiting for you there, where it's been waiting silently and patiently. So when you see that you too are not a separate entity, there's nothing separated in you from anything else, you too recognize when that ends, your suffering ends and you too are delivered. Well, okay, the brochure sounds great, right? We hear that message and we go, okay, and then we close our eyes and all chaos breaks out, right? So it's like the brochure looks great, but how do we actually embark on that journey? How do we take the steps there? So that's the second part I want to talk about, which is also, so this verse is the central tenet of teaching. Our ego has thought this separate individual self that is completely imaginary into existence, and our suffering is there. So the second thing, so what do we do? What do we do about it? Or don't do about it? So the situation is, sounds great, and I close my eyes and I'm stuck in my mind. No matter how calm I try to be, how much center I try to find, it seems like the mind is all there is, right? Every realization comes back to the mind. Everything comes back to it. And you know, we look and practice, and believe me, I've taken this one to the mat. I'm sure many of you have too. You know, to constant disappointment. And, you know, we try to keep focused, you know. Gurdjieff had an analogy to this that was called the fireplace analogy. And his analogy was, we live in a mansion, but we're stuck in the fireplace. Have you had that feeling? You know, you keep turning and you keep searching the fireplace. No matter where you turn, you're still in it. And you know there's something out there. It's like you can you can smell the flowers from the garden, but you can't even see the window it's coming in from. That's what it feels like. That's what our situation, we feel stuck in the mind, right? And we try to work, that's where the mistaken aspect of this teaching, just look at this as a self-improvement program. I'll be better with my reactions, I won't think angry thoughts, I'm gonna be better and better. It will make a better fireplace. And actually it's a work that we need to do just to get to start to move beyond the identification, but it's not the teaching, it's not the gate. So in the words of Adyashanti, who's a teacher I really enjoy listening to, I think it's a real gift to our time. The way we get there, how do we get out of the fireplace, is we have to seek an inner stillness, which means letting everything be exactly how it is. Just let that sink in for a minute. As I was practicing that this morning, the other thing that came to me that described it for me was feeling a complete sense of vulnerability. You know, normally we have sort of, you know, armor around us of how we enter, and it was the sense and practice of just all that peeling off. And it's very tender, and there's some fear there. But being just vulnerable, which means there's no control. So letting everything be exactly as it is. So only then can stillness and silence arise. Now notice that this is different than trying to be still. Have you tried to be still? Yeah, you know, that one just doesn't work because that's a trying and a doing. And it's generally, it doesn't work because trying to be still, trying to find your center, you meditate to find your center, it's a manipulation. It's a kind of control. I don't like where I am right now. I'm scattered. I'm feeling overwhelmed in life. So I'm going to find my center. That is not letting things be how it, that's a manipulation and control. I don't like where I am. I want to be there. That is suffering, is it not? That is suffering. So, you know, when we think stillness is something we have to get to, or leaving things as they are something we have to attain, that inherently suffers, it separates us from it because it's not here. So it's not about the mind thinking or not thinking, although that can happen very naturally. So if you look at all the trying to change and move things as the noise in your inner space, all that noise does arrive within a natural stillness. And so we just sit and watch that noise arising from that place of stillness. So it's stillness isn't something we get to. When you can sit there with, you come in here with the feeling of overwhelm or a feeling of emotional pain or whatever, and you just let it be how it is. You, in fact, you become boundaryless. There's no boundary between you and your experience. That is stillness. It's the only stillness, actually. You know, but and the other thing, as you sit here, more and more deeply you see the myriad ways and levels that the egoic patterns of thinking are always trying to change and resist. It's always trying to do it, and you understand why the stillness doesn't appear. And when you just can see it, and even just let all those processes go, and like, what's the process of having the ego constantly churning? The stillness is there too. You don't have to change anything. You've just gone beyond it. So what is needed is to stop getting to something. Right effort is to stop pushing, to stop trying, to stop searching, to stop this impulsive need to do something. So we talk a lot about suffering being caused by our resisting life, needing to do and stretch and grasp and stuff, the second noble truth. But as long as you are struggling with what's happening for you, you will never get beyond your conditioned way of seeing things. That's really important. As long as we're struggling, manipulating or controlling, we'll never move beyond the fireplace. We'll never get out of our conditioned way of seeing things. So in practice, so it's interesting, here's what I underlined. For a lot of us, we get there and this lack of doing sounds like a really passive approach of life. Well, if I'm not worried about it, who's gonna feed the cat? Who will make sure the bills get paid? Who's gonna get that project done? So it feels like a passive laying back and it feels like an anathema, but in truth, this constantly seeing all this manipulation and this control that goes on all the time takes an inordinate amount of mindfulness, an incredible amount of energy and resting and awareness. Eventually, it'll take everything you have. It'll take mm-hmm. your life to really see this process. That's kind of scary. Mm-hmm. But in return, it gives you the only life that's truly we were born to live, which is beyond the separation. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who was a Christian who was imprisoned by the Nazis during World War II, some of you may be familiar with his readings. I was really influenced by him in high school, and in his book, Letters and Papers from Prison, he had this concept of cheap grace and costly grace. And cheap grace, I think I can remember his quote was, forgiveness without repentance, church membership without church discipline, taking something without giving something back. And he said, it's cheap because it doesn't really get you anywhere. He said, costly discipline is the discipline that costs you your life, but it gives you a life worth living. He's basically saying what we're doing here, the same process. And so in that Gurdjieff analogy, when you stop trying to find your way out of the fireplace, really just are still in that fireplace. Stop trying, stop searching, stop resisting, everything simply appears. So take a moment right now and just allow this to sink in. Because we have all this doing and pushing and trying, and much of it is very good intentioned. In fact, it skillfully may have put us where we are. So that's not the enemy. But take a moment and consider that stopping trying, stopping assuming that something that you're looking for is just out of your experience, just around the corner. And it's here. Stop trying. I invite you to make that your life. Thank you so much.